Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation with astronaut Sunita Williams, who set several records for women in space, including the first man or woman to run a marathon up there. But first, a report from the Iraqi government shows civilian deaths from violence halved this month, down from 1,773 killed in August to 884 civilians killed in September. The number of wounded Iraqis is also half, 850 this past month, as opposed to over 1,500 in August. The Iraqi statistics parallel the U.S. troop toll as well. According to the website iCasualties.org, which tracks U.S. military deaths, the death toll in September was the lowest since July 2006. Paul Tate of Reuters is in Baghdad. Paul, how are these numbers registering there?
They're being registered with some happiness, I guess is one word to use. Most of it is being attributed to the so-called surge in U.S. troops that began in mid-February in Baghdad and spread out into areas around the capital since then. And in mid-June, the final elements of the five extra brigades, the 30,000 extra U.S. troops, were deployed, and I guess we can see the results of that in the figures that are starting to come out since then.
But we'd also been hearing reports of attacks against clerical leaders, tribal leaders. These are the ones U.S. Officials hoped would help lead the fighting against insurgents the way tribal leaders did in Anbar province. What's been the impact of that?
There's no doubt that there are still continuing sectarian attacks. I think what they're particularly happy about is that the number of spectacular attacks, as they call them, the really large-scale bombings have come down. By getting troops out of the larger bases and into what they call combat outposts in communities, they've been slowly winning over, they say, the trust of local Iraqis who, in turn, have made it easier for them to discover weapons caches. At the same time as these casualty figures coming down, you'll find that the number of weapons caches being found has gone up, and that's what gives them cause for some optimism. But having said that, as they themselves have said on Sunday, the number of attacks are still too high, and there are still many sectarian attacks that go on in Baghdad and around Iraq every week. But all of this, again, is against the backdrop of Muqtada al-Sadr's Shiite militia, the Mahdi army, more or less holding to his order to cease their activities for now. Of course, one would have to expect that the number of attacks would go up again once the Mahdi army decides that it no longer is going to abide by that ceasefire.
We also want to ask you about something that jumped out at us, which is that the figures from the Iraqi government also reported the deaths of 366 militants. That's also a far drop from August of 106, and also a drop in the number of detentions of insurgents or militants by about a quarter. And so if less militants were killed and less detained, but the number of civilian deaths still went down, does that mean that there are less militants, period?
That is the one figure that really stood out from the figures that were released yesterday. I think you could probably put that down to a large degree to the Jaish al-Mahdi, the Mahdi army, holding off from its campaigns down in the south.
Al-Qaeda forces in Iraq, although smaller in number than the insurgent nationalist forces, had threatened to increase attacks during Ramadan. Does that have people still on edge?
Oh, absolutely. I think you could safely say that U.S. commanders are always on edge when it comes to Al-Qaeda and the possibility of large-scale attacks.
Paul Tate of Reuters speaking to us from Iraq about the drop in violence recorded in a recent Iraqi government report. Paul, thank you.
You're welcome.
Fifty years ago this week, an announcement from Radio Moscow, broadcast in English, inaugurated the space age.
As a result of intensive work by research institutes and designing bureaus, The first artificial Earth satellite in the world has now been created.
Sputnik was little more than a beeping metal ball, but the news from the Soviets stunned the U.S. and hardened the frost in the Cold War. 50 years after Sputnik, the Soviet Union is no longer, and Russia and the U.S. are space partners on some levels. Cosmonauts and astronauts like Sunita Williams living together on the International Space Station. The Naval Academy grad and Desert Storm helicopter pilot was selected by NASA in 1998. She launched into space in 2006 aboard the shuttle Discovery, and once at the space station, set records for women with spacewalks totaling 29 hours and a total of 195 days in space. She came back to Earth in June of this year, and I sat down with her at the JFK Library in Boston recently. Williams graduated from Needham High School outside of Boston in 1983. She was warmly received by the hometown crowd. Is there a time when you're in space when there's something that happens that you really feel where you are?
Oh, yeah. We have big cameras, so we're usually always trying to take pictures of the Earth and trying to get that one shot of Cape Cod, and zoop, it's gone. Mm-hmm. That's sort of annoying, you know, because you're going 17,500 miles an hour. You see 16 sunrises and sunsets, so as you're, you know, trying to, you know, get that other picture of someplace, and all of a sudden, you know, oh, shoot, it's nighttime already over there. And those types of things that really dawn on you that you're going pretty darn fast. So.
Yeah. Do any of the astronauts ever have a moment where you need to be calmed down a little bit, where the enormity of what you're doing, you know, maybe hits one of you, or is it just work?
I would say it's usually just work. And I shouldn't say just, because it's cool work. Right. Every day you get up, you're like, ooh, what are we going to do today? But I think every now and then it dawns on you that you're living in a little can in space where the temperatures are pretty violent and you're in the vacuum of space. We were in an interesting orbit at one point in time where the left side of the spacecraft was always in the sunlight. I'm sure the spacecraft is rated for this, but you would hear little creaks and stuff like that. And we opened one of those hatches, and it's black, just like the front of the space station. And so you could feel that heat just emanating in there. And so you sort of think to yourself, I hope this is all going to work. And, when you're out on a spacewalk, we've practiced it so much that when you open the hatch and you go out, you feel like, okay, this is just normal. I'm in the pool at Johnson Space Center. I know what I'm doing. But every now and then, you know, when there's a moment to stop, you might have asked a question to the ground, and you looked out, and the Earth is just zipping by you. I mean, it makes you stop and just go, wow, this is pretty amazing, and I hope my spacesuit works. Every time I came in, I gave my spacesuit a big hug.
Yeah, I would bet. When I was coming here, some people said to me, ask her about faith. You know, you're up there in what people would call the heavens. And, you know, are there conversations about things like that with the cosmonauts, or even internally with yourself?
Oh, yeah. We wake up in the morning, we have a conference, and then you go to work. And at nighttime, everyone sort of gathers together and has dinner. And that's when you have some of those reflective conversations about, you know, what are we doing up here, and why are we here, and why are actually we on Earth? Those moments like that when you stop and start reflecting about this ball that we're living on, then you start really wondering, you know, what's it all about?
Would you conclude? You know, because, I mean, when we were all kids, the whole thing was, I mean, everyone went through this. Where does it end? You know, what's the end of the universe? And then what's beyond that? And
I think the best way to answer that question is sort of like, I think when kids ask me, do you think there's aliens out there? Did you see any? I haven't seen any, I have to tell you. First disclaimer, I haven't seen any aliens, but I couldn't imagine there isn't something out there that's living and beside for us. You look at all those stars out there. When you're up in space, you're above the atmosphere of the Earth. So, it's like the darkest place that you could find with it at night, when you can see millions and millions and millions of stars. And they don't twinkle because you're above the atmosphere. They're just bright spots of light. And you got to think that that's what our sun looks like, you know. And so around all of those little stars out there are there planets. And on those planets, does anything have a makeup like we do here that could support some type of life? It makes you feel pretty special and pretty small, I think, all in one.
We, of course, all know about your colleague, astronaut Lisa Nowak, who went on the cross-country trip to seek retribution against what she perceived as a romantic rival. And after that happened, NASA promised to monitor the mental health of astronauts more, and they came out with a study in which they found
that, in fact, there had been incidents of astronauts flying within a time frame that they're not supposed to after having been drunk. Are there things like this that are going on in the program that, you know, safety questions people like you have to deal with?
A little difficult question to answer because I really don't have a good answer for it, except for the fact that I've gone through one launch count, you know, from firsthand experience, and it would be really difficult to do just because everything is down to the wire. You know, the launch count starts a number of days beforehand where the vehicle is being programmed. And parallel to that is the astronauts. We go into quarantine days beforehand, and you have things that you're going to do right up until the time that you launch. From my experience and the experience, you know, of my crewmates, I can't really even imagine that being a realistic concern.
Mm-hmm. I started thinking when that report came out that there was a time when we first started flying in space that people who were chosen to be astronauts were out of their minds. I mean, they were expected to be risk takers and sort of, you know, the real sort of cowboys of outer space. They were test pilots, and they always lived on the edge. And there was always this sort of winking nod that there was this kind of lifestyle, and that's why mm-hmm. they went up in these cans, you know, to outer space. And that now suddenly, you know, that kind of, maybe, you know, whatever, however you'd characterize it, is being called into question. Has there been sort of a shift in...
Oh, yeah. I think absolutely. I mean, half of the astronaut corps comes from a test pilot background. There is, you know, a brotherhood in that system. But half of the astronauts are also scientists and doctors. And also our role is a little bit different. The spacecraft that we're going on have flown a number of times. I'm not going to say they're not tests. Aircraft or test spacecraft, but they've flown a number of times, and our mission is not just to launch and come back to Earth, but our mission is to get out there and understand what it is to live and work in microgravity and how we can use this experience, this laboratory, to build the next generation of spacecraft. Everybody who launches on a space shuttle, I went through this a couple days beforehand of, you know, you sort of want your life in order, your friends and family in order, your dog at the right place and everything all in order, because you know there's a chance that you might not be coming back, but you know that you go through that and then you move on, and we're trained pretty highly trained for what we're doing, and people take it very seriously.
You know, you mentioned that wanting your life in order, and you and your husband have a dog that dog that you love, and I probably should ask this of a male astronaut as well, but do you think if you had children, do you think you would go up? Or do you think it's harder for the astronauts who do?
Well, you know, a 6-year-old boy asked me the other day would I go to Mars if I knew it was a one-way trip. And I asked him, would you? And I'm not sure he was ready for me to ask him that, but I said, you know, it's your generation that might be doing that, so you better start thinking about that. But I think, really, if you felt what you were doing, if I felt what I was doing was for a good purpose that was going to help folks on Earth and in humanity and what we're trying to accomplish in peaceful, with nations working together, then, yeah, I think it would be worth it.
That's astronaut Sunita Williams. We spoke before an audience at the Kennedy Library here in Boston. I also asked her what she said to critics of the cost of the space program or those who think the shuttle should be retired, and she said she still feels it's worth it because of the advances that might be found in space. Well, just ahead, the kids ask their questions. Also later today, why conservative Republicans are floating the idea of a third-party candidate. That's all ahead here and now. We're back with more of our conversation with astronaut Sunita Williams, recorded before an audience at the JFK Library here in Massachusetts, where Sunny was raised. But she is of Indian descent, and I asked her if she's aware of how her shuttle flights were celebrated in India.
Actually, I'll have to tell you a cool story. I got an email from a friend of mine. Her husband is in Iraq. The barbers in the Green Zone are Indian contractors, and they stopped what they were doing to watch Atlantis land. And he said, what are you guys doing? You know, I have to get my hair cut. I'm on a timeline here. He's like, well, you know, Sunny Williams is landing on the shuttle. This is in the Green Zone, so that's cool. And so I think I'm getting the message that people are pretty psyched about it.
Well, as audience members lined up to ask questions, I asked Sunny about being a role model for kids.
somebody asked me the other day about being a role model, and I sort of had to take a step back, like, oh, I guess maybe I need to think about this a little bit. And I take it pretty seriously. I think the things that we're doing are things that anybody, any young girl can do. Any limitations that you have in your mind between what you can do and what some little boy can do or what some guy can do is just a border that you put in your mind. The helicopters I flew didn't know whether or not I was a girl or a boy. The spacesuit didn't know whether or not I was a girl or a boy. So why should that be a limitation? Mm-hmm. So I hope I am, translating that type of message to all the young women out there that they got to come up and beat my record or nails I can. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting old, so we need some people to take my place in the space program. So let's go.
We have a question for Sunny.
Keep in the chest over here in the suit?
What did I keep in this part of the spacesuit right in front? Well, that's all our controls. While you're out there, right, this little space suit is actually a spacecraft. It has all your oxygen in it, all your carbon dioxide removal. It has heating and cooling. It has a battery in there. It also has information about, like, a backup oxygen in case your primary oxygen went away. So all of those pieces of information are displayed on what we call a display control module right here. So we have a little screen, and we can toggle through and look at everything how our suit is working. There's also a... Come on over here.
Wow. Suddenly, a 5-year-old girl in an orange flight suit bounded onto the stage. I'd asked earlier if someone had come in costume. She was all alone, but listen to her answer when I ask her name.
And Isabel and Mel.
Actually, her name is Isabel, Isabel George. We found out later, Aiden and Mel are her imaginary friends. So with that testimony to the spirit of future astronauts, here are some more of the questions.
Actually, two questions. Did you get to use both American and Russian spacesuits in your spacewalks? And also, what kind of tracking do they do for orbital debris when you're outside?
I only went out in a U.S. spacesuit. However, we're trained in both suits before we go, just in case anything happens. And for protection or what type of tracking? Well, there's folks on the ground. They're tracking anything on the ground that's like a softball size. And really for the space station, we are in an orbit that has an inclination above the equator. We can't change that inclination that we're flying. However, we can change our altitude by the way we boost. We can change our attitude by the way we turn to potentially help and prevent us from hitting anything. So little micrometeorites that we're not going to be able to see, and we have micrometeorite protection on both the suits and the space station itself. We've seen some evidence that every now and then there's some damage here and there. But that spacecraft is made to withstand that type of stuff.
Thank you.
How does it feel to sleep in space? Because you're in this small, confined area.
It's a great question because my thought beforehand was, oh, this is going to be like sleeping on a hammock. It'll be just, nice and comfortable. No, you don't have to turn over because your shoulder hurts or something like that. That was true. However, it was very difficult to get used to sleeping in space. I'm 40-ish, and my brain has registered that I put my head on a pillow, I lay down on a bed, and that feels comfortable to me. So to just sort of have your head floating around, bobbing, or like a bobblehead, it's like, this is weird. And I ended up having a little bit of a neck cramp because I was like straining my neck to hold it still unconsciously, and also likewise my stomach to hold myself. It took a little while to get used to all that.
Why wouldn't they? Would they ever put you in a head harness?
Yeah, we have those. Actually, we have like a little Velcro strap that can go across your head. And some people have recommended sleeping with a bungee across them. But I guess maybe this is the adventurous side in me. I said, I want to adapt. I want to see if I can do this. And lo and behold, you can.
Were you able to see the Earth rotate or revolve or even wobble a little around the sun or on its axis?
How to answer this question? Not as you're describing it. We're aware of it turning. We're flying a little bit too fast to see that happening, but the second time we'd come around in orbit, we wouldn't be at the same place over the Earth. So if you think about that, so you know it's spinning beneath you, because if it wasn't spinning, you'd be coming over the same place each time. And we would see on a map or a computer program that we use called World Map or Sigma, two of them, we'd see how much we would move, which meant how much the Earth would turn.
That's so cool that you had no point of reference ever up there.
No. Yeah.
Okay. I think we have one last question over here.
Did you miss space more than Earth?
Oh, it's a great question. Yeah, you know what? I have to say I really do miss space a lot. And the driver which keeps me here and wanting to be here are the people. But being in space is absolutely fun and cool. And I am happy that I actually have the ability to have dreams about being in space since I was there. Every time I walk into a room like this and I look at the ceiling, I look how high it is, and I think about how cool it would be to jump off the floor and fly up there and fly back down and, you know, push off the front and go there. I mean, your perspective on life makes you laugh every now and then when you see pretty cool places like that to do stuff like that. I really, really miss being in space, but I think it's the people that keep you here.
Sunita Williams, Needham's own. Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
Astronaut Sunita Williams answering questions at the JFK Library in Boston. For more information or to see a picture of future astronaut Isabel in her Halloween costume flight suit, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, 80% of private security contractors in Iraq are not U.S. citizens, so how do you prosecute them if they're accused of wrongdoing? That's tomorrow. And still ahead today, a battle over the cost of college textbooks and a wild weekend for Republicans. That's all after the news, Here and Now. What a weekend the Republicans had. We spoke of the Democratic presidential candidate's race on Friday. Today, a look at the GOP. Newt Gingrich is out of the running for president, and influential conservative Christians in the group Council for National Policy met over the weekend in Salt Lake City. They told reporters they would consider backing a third-party candidate if the Republicans nominate a pro-abortion candidate such as Rudy Giuliani. Whit Ayers is a Republican pollster and strategist. He joins us now. Whit, welcome back.
Hello, Robin. How are you?
Good. Is this just muscle flexing by this conservative wing of the party? I mean, prominent conservatives such as James Dobson of Focus on the Family were there. How serious is this threat?
Well, it's always been a consideration if you consider the possibility that Rudy Giuliani will get the Republican nomination. That's one of the reasons why, should he get the nomination, he is likely to pick a strong social conservative to be his vice presidential nominee, somebody like Mike Huckabee. But that kind of tension is always present in political coalitions. And so it's not surprising that you're seeing some of it surface now.
Well, Giuliani responded by saying Republicans still want a candidate who's strong on terrorism. Is that going to resonate with conservative Christian Republicans? And does it matter, you know, how big is the core?
It certainly matters with conservative Christian Republicans. The issue mix is different today than it was before 9/11. And that's one of the reasons why Rudy Giuliani has stayed atop the pack for the Republican nomination. There are a lot of
I just want to jump in to say issue mix, you know, gay marriage, abortion rights. We're not hearing a lot of those issues out on the trail.
Well, they're still there, but terrorism and Iraq and foreign policy are so much more dominant now than they were in the presidential election in 2000. That the issue mix is different, and consequently, the candidates who appeal to the right issue mix are different today.
Oh, by the way, Giuliani's campaign was also criticized for sending out a fundraising plea for $9.11, a not-so-subtle reminder of his role post-9/11. They pulled it, but is that 9/11 hero theme, you know, potentially going to backfire on Giuliani as well if he pushes
no,
it too
not.
Hard? No?
No, it's not, Robin.
Mm-hmm.
He had the most perfect political pitch of any politician I have ever seen right after 9/11. You go back and listen to his speeches, some of which he gave off the cuff, and you wouldn't change a single word today. It was a superlative performance. He deserves to have the exalted status he has in American history because of it.
Okay. We'll see what, you know, voters say to that about that as we continue on. But Richard Viguerie, one of the other major conservative Christians at that meeting we mentioned in Utah, says two other Republican candidates, Mitt Romney and John McCain, are not faring well with his side of the party either. We're wondering, though, if McCain may have been trying to and may have scored some points with them in this interview he did with the website BeliefNet. Now, he said his Christian faith is probably better guidance for the nation than a Muslims, but then let's listen further.
I just have to say in all candor that since this nation was founded primarily on Christian principles, that that's a decision that the American people would make, but personally, I prefer someone who I know was a solid grounding in my faith. But that doesn't mean that I'm sure that someone who is Muslim would not make a good president.
You know, we feel like we're hearing him struggle there. I just want to say the Council for American Islamic Relations, you know, blasted the remarks, asked McCain to make a clarification. He did, saying, "I would vote for a Muslim if he or she was the candidate best able to lead the country and defend our political values." This is a sticky thicket here.
It's a sticky thicket because we have no establishment of religion, but the overwhelming majority of Americans consider themselves Christian. So it's not surprising that you would have a candidate saying, "I would like to have a leader who shares the fundamental values of my faith." But those values aren't confined to Christians. And I don't think he said that he wanted a Christian president.
Okay. What about former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney? His lead in New Hampshire is gone, according to a recent poll. Giuliani has caught up with him in New Hampshire. Of course, New Hampshire neighboring, you know, Massachusetts, where he was governor. How would you assess Romney's campaign at this point?
I think it's been superlatively run. He has targeted the early states. He has a lead in Iowa. He's either first or in a tie for first in New Hampshire. He is the insider's front runner, as opposed to Rudy Giuliani, who's the national front runner. I think he's done a superb job thus far. He's built a strong organization in key states. He's well-funded, and he's got a consistent message. I don't know how you can do much better than that when you start without a national name.
Well, you know, and some would say that his message, though, is a tricky line for him to walk because he at one point after winning in Iowa said people want change. Well, but that would mean him, you know, criticizing the Bush administration. He said Washington is a mess, it's broken and needs to be fixed. Is that a difficult line for him?
It's not a difficult line if you haven't been a part of the Senate and had to vote on a lot of the things that he's talking about changing. That's one of the reasons why people look to people who aren't in the Washington establishment, people like Rudy Giuliani and Mitt Romney and Mike Huckabee, are folks who have a certain appeal because they're not part of the Washington establishment that people find distasteful.
We just want to ask you one quick last Romney question. He'd been criticized for his comment that his five sons did not serve in the military because he said one of the ways they were serving the country is by helping him get elected. As you know, Romney had a contest on his website where you could create an ad for his campaign. And Slate.com did a spoof ad using the Band of Brothers cable series World War II music theme, but showing Romney's sons. Here they are, a little bit of them on a campaign bus going across Iowa.
We hit a couple of bugs that made the windshield glow. We looked out and noticed fields full of fireflies. We pulled over just to have a look.
They have children of their own, and they're
putting
those things
aside. This question seems to be dogging Romney as he goes around at campaign stops. You know, your sons did not serve, and yet you are backing the war.
Governor Romney later said that he was in no way equating his son's service in his campaign with service in the armed forces overseas. So I think that's more of his enemies taking some pot shots at him than a real issue.
Okay, real quick, because we want to get you in on this. Newt Gingrich said over the weekend he will not run for president. He said because of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform bill, he discovered that he legally can't explore the presidential bid in the way he wanted to over the Internet. Your thoughts on Newt Gingrich dropping out?
Well, I think it was inevitable if he couldn't continue on with this idea think tank, American Solutions, that he started. But it's another indication of the unintended consequences of our campaign finance reform system. We keep trying to make the system better and end up making it worse by doing things like taking major candidates out of the race.
Wood Ayers, Republican strategist and pollster. He's president of Ayers, McHenry & Associates in Washington, D.C. Wood, thanks as always for weighing in with us.
Good talking to you, Robin.
We'll talk to you again. And just a reminder, you can listen to anything on today's program by going to hear-now.org, and you can download a podcast there as well. And before we go today, a couple of rockers go from roots to punk to rockabilly. That's still ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. The cost of college textbooks has climbed at twice the rate of inflation over the past 20 years, with books costing about $900 a year. At Harvard University, a group of students launched a website to allow students to comparison shop online for their course books. But the group had problems finding out which books students need, since traditionally, professors at Harvard and other universities send the required reading list to the university bookstore. So the Harvard students went to the bookstore, known as the Coop, to copy down the course book information and were kicked out by bookstore workers who said, hey, this information is proprietary. John Staff is director of the student group known as Crimson Reading. He joins us. And tell us what happened when students went to the Coop to copy these lists.
We've been there several times collecting this book information. We get most of it from professors, but have to go to the Coop because they have it arranged by course. And once the Coop caught on to this, they asked our employees and volunteers to leave several times.
You said employees. Does your group, Crimson Reading, do you have employees?
Crimson Reading does hire some students to help us collect this information. Most of them do not go to the Coop. Most of them collect it from professors and through the Internet. But Crimson Reading is nonprofit. After our expenses, everything we make goes to help build schools and other infrastructure in Zambia.
Really? Who funds you?
Right. The money comes through online referrals. So when you use our website, crimsonreading.org, to purchase a book, we get about a 5-7% referral commission that comes not from the buyer but from the seller.
So you're no fools. I mean, you've made this, you know, sort of an entrepreneurial as well as something that has a philosophical backing to it.
Right. It's important to us because it's saving students money on the front end, which I think is the most important charity, but also donating on the back end.
Now, the Coop, which used to be a student co-op, hence the name Coop, is now run by Barnes & Noble Books. They say they go to the time and expense of putting these lists together, and they don't have any obligation to share this with anyone, especially a competitor, which you are. Do they have a point?
They may have a point. To point out, they still are a cooperative. They are only managed by Barnes & Noble. I still own them as a student and as a member of the Harvard Coop. The proprietary argument, I think, is wrong. I think they are a cooperative aimed at helping students, so they should share that information. But our main beef is not with the Harvard Coop. It's with Harvard College. What we'd like to see is a centralized book information system where these ISBN numbers would be available to all students.
ISBN, that's the publishing information?
Right.
Yeah. Well, that would seem to be the real problem. You know, why are professors sending information to a bookstore? Why aren't they sending it directly to students, let's say, through a Harvard website?
There seems to be a longstanding tradition where they send it to the bookstore. It would be much easier for them to send it to one central entity in the college, which then distributes it to the bookstore, to student websites like Crimson Reading, and to the Harvard libraries.
We've done other reporting on this, other ways that kids are really trying to cut down on this huge expense. The larger debate seems to be that professors are calling for newer editions every year, so it's very hard to buy used ones. What do you see as some of the other issues around books?
Well, I think the edition question is certainly a good one when you're constantly updating books with really not much that's new. That is a problem that is exponentiated at Harvard when you have some professors who are actually writing the books and have an interest in selling more copies.
Well, and explain to someone, you know, Harvard University costs, what, about $44,000 a year now?
And like $47,000,
yeah. Okay. So why is $900 so important to a Harvard student, someone
sure
might ask?
People like to focus on that, you know, near $50,000 price tag. But the fact is, I believe now the majority of Harvard College students are on financial aid. I myself am on financial aid, so this is a financial burden.
And I know from experience that, you know, young people going off to school on financial aid have no clue what they're then facing. I mean, $1,000, if you don't have it for books, is you're nodding your head yes, is pretty much of a shock.
Yeah, every semester it's incredible, and I thought I was doing pretty well. I ordered all my books online, of course, many of them used, and I was at about $380, but what they throw on top of that is these course packs, which are compilations of articles and book chapters that professors put together that really they have a monopoly on because they're only sold at one place. They're unique, so once I added those in, that put me at about $800.
Really?
It really is shocking to students who come in that they really are this expensive and you do need them.
John Staff heads the student group CrimsonReading.org, which posts textbook information online. And they're now battling with Harvard University over gaining access to a list of course books. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, still ahead, from punk to roots to rockabilly, John Spencer and Matt Verderay take out the heavy trash. That's after a minute break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
I want to sing about my sweet baby. A pretty little baby with a diamond ring.
And that's Heavy Trash, the newest incarnation of John Spencer, the avant rocker who formed the band Pussy Galore and later the John Spencer Blues Explosion. He's joined by Matt Verderay, virtuoso guitarist late of the bands Matt Arose and Speedball Baby. Together, their musical history runs the American roots gamut from Elvis Presley and the Sun Studios era to James Brown at the Apollo to punkster Iggy Pop with a bit of a deranged preacher thrown in.
Oh, Dada, Dada, please, why don't you stay at home? I said, how's it going? Tell me what's going on. Got to find the birds, got to run.
We're not quite sure how to peg it, but the new CD from Heavy Trash is going way out, and they join us now from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome to John Spencer.
Hi.
And Matt Verderay, welcome to you as well.
Hi, how are you, Adam?
I'm fine. John Spencer, what would you call it?
I call it rock and roll, and I also call it rockabilly. And rockabilly is the reason that Matt and I started this band. We've both been kicking around New York City for about 20 years playing in different groups, like you said. And Heavy Trash was a chance for us to get together and to play rockabilly.
Right. Matt Verderay, John has said some of the things that influenced you, but what was it that drew you to the sound?
My mother had a great record collection. She was always really into music, and she had some Sun records, and specifically one particular one, a Johnny Cash one with Get Rhythm on one side and I Walk the Line on the other. I still actually have the record up on my wall in my living room. But just there was always music around the house, and I didn't exactly know what rockabilly was. I didn't know there was a name for it, but I knew that there's a certain sound that attracted me, and I just went for that sound. And then by the time I got around to trying to organize it in my brain, that's what I figured out it was called.
Yeah. Yeah. Do we understand that also you were once given sort of a tutorial by Bo Diddley?
Oh, yeah. We lived in Canada. We went to an outdoor fair. Bo Diddley was playing, and it was in the 70s. They didn't really have kind of nostalgia stuff happening yet, so nobody was there. It was just 12 of us in the audience, and Bo came out at the end of the show and just sat on the edge of the stage and talked to us. It was really cool. He was a cool guy.
And if we were in a movie, that would be John Spencer with the score of the movie playing along. That's the sound. If you could, we want to hear a little more of the CD. But if you could, John, since you got the guitar right there, there's so much sound in the new CD.
Thank you for noticing.
But is there another sort of rhythm that you could play that would sort of say what the CD is?
I mean, right at the top, you got pure gold, heavy trash, rock and roll.
Pure gold. It sounds like, an old R&B record. We played Crazy Pretty Baby to start. That sounds like it could have been recorded in 1956. I want to listen to a little more. Let's listen to You Can't Win.
Wearing sideburns and shoe leather and dead animal skins. But hey, if the suit smells, wear it.
Now, we read that this is about a rockabilly band that's frustrated at being pigeonholed by the industry. Everybody's mad at the industry right now. I mean, don't get Joni Mitchell started. Do you really think that this would make what's left of radio?
Honestly, no. But, I guess I still hold out a hope. I don't think it's really the industry that's got me down. I think it's, this country. There's not a lot of respect for my kind of music, which is a shame because this is where the rock and roll came from. That's nothing new, but it does bother me, sure.
Matt, why do you think that is? Because in many ways it's so uniquely American.
I think one of the reasons this particular culture has gotten so sort of standardized and blandified is that too many people have too much to gain from its being that way. What I enjoy about sort of 50s and 60s culture is not like Fabian and Elvis Presley movies. It's more like when Elvis was at his weirdest and when Moondog was out on the street reciting poetry and, when Don Van Vliet was digging up his whatever went into his psychology so he could make those records later on. sort of the weirder stuff about America that appealed to Burroughs and Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg, when weird stuff could still slip through, that is sort of what I'm nostalgic for, not sort of, you know, diners and Fonzie and stuff. So.
Yeah. Well, it would seem appropriate that we might end our conversation by listening to That Ain't Right, your nod to Waylon Jennings and Johnny Cash's record at Folsom Prison. And just briefly how this came about, John?
I don't know. I just wanted to write a kind of mean song. And, yeah, it's definitely influenced by the early Johnny Cash Sun records. As far as Waylon Jennings, like you mentioned in particular, there's a song called That's What You Get For, I think it's called For Loving Me, a great song. And so I thought it'd be nice to write a kind of mean song like that about love gone wrong.
Say goodbye to what was, that is gone just because. You took me for granted, never cherished my love. Now one of these days, there's no more us.
I'm not sure I want to leave it on that note, actually. Okay. You know, I was talking about, you know, popular culture today and, you know, mean songs. I guess, maybe, John, you know, just tell me a little bit more about when you are performing. I've read that it becomes almost like a religious revival.
Yeah, I mean, I love this kind of music. I love rock and roll, and I really love playing with heavy trash. And when the concert starts, I just get carried away. And
yeah, if I might interject from my side of the stage, watching John get himself and people in the audience into a trance, it's very reminiscent of, you know, what I imagine a Baptist revival might be. But it's no different than any kind of trance-oriented group experience, you know. John's great at it.
So, some of the things I read you shout out, this day is mine. I still believe in the tooth fairy.
I may have said that. I don't know. You know, a lot of stuff goes down. A lot of stuff happens. But I do love it.
But there's one word. Well, actually, you break it into three. Baby.
Baby.
Baby. We play a little bit of Back Off. Now.
Yeah, that's right. Every track. Baby. I'm feeling all right. Ladies and gentlemen, Heavy Trash got a new record album. Go way out with Heavy Trash. That's it coming from me, John Spencer, and my good friend, Mr. Matt Bergeray. Look for us out on the road, America. Heavy Trash. Thank you, baby. Baby!
Heavy Trash.
That's the one I wanted. John Spencer, Matt Bergeray, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And for more on their tour, go to our website, here-now.org.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.